good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bride silver.
With good financial oversight, we could find $48 billion in loose change in that building without having to hit the taxpayers.
You're listening to episode 568 of Unwelcome Guests, our 9/10 anniversary special edition. Now, this will actually be mostly about the events of 9/11. I called it the 9/10 special edition to draw particular attention to what I think is one of the key circumstances which helps us understand what's going on. Now, I called it the special edition because I'd make a special effort to make it approachable to new listeners. Now, look at our 9/11 page, unwelcomeguest.net/911. We'll reveal about 50 episodes on the topic, so regular listeners are coming at this with a body of knowledge. So it's something of a challenge to make a show which is of interest both to regular listeners and to new listeners. But I wanted to have something that, if you're a regular listener, you might be able to point one of your friends to help them see what's going on. Now, I avoided listening to Lynn's talking about 911 for a couple of years because I thought, well, it's a complex matter and I don't know if it's a conspiracy or not, but I think people will probably work it out in the end. And when I did eventually catch up and listen to the 911 episodes, some of it was grim listening, but it did make perfect sense. So this is by no means a compendious and detailed look at 9/11, but we're going to catch up on some of the most important details, looking also at how it's been treated by commercial media. And we're going to start with the CBS Eye on America report about the events of Monday, September the 10th, 2001.
Pentagon. The day before 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld declared war, not on foreign terrorists.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
He said money wasted by the military poses a serious threat.
In fact, it could be said that it's a matter of life and death.
Rumsfeld promised change, but the next day, the world changed. And in the rush to fund the war on terrorism, the war on waste seems to have been forgotten.
My 03 budget calls for more than $48 billion in new defense spending.
More money for the Pentagon when its own auditors admit the military cannot account for 25% of what it already spends.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and he says, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback, you know. My supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job. So.
He was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
They got to cover it up. That's where the corruption comes in. They've got to cover up the fact that they can't do the job.
The Pentagon's Inspector General partially substantiated several of Minnery's allegations, but could not prove officials tried to manipulate the financial statements. 20 years ago, Pentagon employee Franklin C. Spinney made headlines exposing what he calls the accounting games. He's still there, and although he does not speak for the Pentagon, he believes the problem has gotten worse.
Those numbers are pie in the sky. The books are cooked routinely, year after year after year.
Retired Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan commanded the Navy's Second Fleet the first time Donald Rumsfeld served as Defense Secretary.
With good financial oversight, we could find $48 billion in loose change in that building without having to hit the taxpayer.
In the 2.5 minutes since this report began, the Pentagon has spent nearly $2 million, and it may never know where 25% of those tax dollars went. In Los Angeles, I'm Vince Gonzalez for Eye on America.
Now, I don't watch a lot of television, and I certainly don't watch a lot of U.S. television, so I don't know how much this was followed up either on the day or subsequently. Notice that they avoided talking about theft or misplaced money. They talked about waste the whole time. So while they were talking about that, did you imagine something like food that had been left out of the fridge and gone bad so nobody can get to eat it? Well, that's a shame. All that money going to waste. Well, money doesn't work like that. If somebody got overcharged for $300 million, somebody got that $300 million. Does this perhaps explain why, although his charges were partially substantiated, people didn't say, gosh, you got a point here, we'd better get to the bottom of this. They transferred him and said, oh, well, we'll write this off. This is, on a larger scale, the same phenomenon that we saw about the US air conditioning tents to the tune of $20 billion a year without bothering to insulate them first. If you're a US taxpayer, you may be concerned about the fact that you're paying people to start wars and kill foreigners. Have you noticed that that's not even true about a large proportion of the money? If their internal accounts department says it's a quarter of the money, I can't believe it's less than that, and I can't believe it's not more than that, because it's very easy to do overbilling. This is a standard thing when you buy something. You agree a price, and then you say, okay, how much should we put on the receipt? So does this money actually make America safer, because a large proportion of it is getting squirreled away, put in the Swiss bank accounts of greedy opportunists, psychopaths, or whoever else? Now, this seems like a pretty clear example of what Illich was talking about in Deschooling Society. The US military claims it's there to protect you and make things safer for Americans, but in practice, they have a vested interest in starting wars. Now, as far as the timing goes, this is unexpected for a Monday. The admission that you can't account for a quarter of all the money that you've ever been given is, by anybody's definition, I would have thought, embarrassing. And the usual time for making such embarrassing announcements is, say, late on a Friday afternoon, or just before you nip off for a Christmas holiday, and then you hope it'll have all blown over by the time you get back. Okay, a pretty bold hope in this case, but hey, somebody got lucky, or was it just luck? Because the next day, nobody was talking about the trillions of dollars that got stolen, unaccounted for. So, as a statistician, I've got to say yes, there is a chance that those who timed the September the 10th announcement had no idea about what was going to unfold on the next day. It just strikes me as about the perfect time to make such an announcement, if one had foreknowledge. Now, Donald Rumsfeld figures later on in the show, and of course we got a lot of evidence in earlier episodes that his role in this may not be benign. And now we can hear the soundtrack of a new video by architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. This is a group of 1,500 architects and engineers who are combined to say the official story is junk, we don't believe a word of it, and we would like an official investigation. Now, I should have said earlier, actually, this show has a webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/568, where you can download the videos. So if you're listening on the internet, you might find that a superior solution.
Throughout the ages, architects and engineers have designed and built the great structures that have made our world and withstood the test of time. Hi, I'm Ed Asner. Welcome to Architects and Engineers. Let's look now at modern steel frame buildings. This is the Empire State Building, a marvel of modern architecture. It was built to last. Architects and engineers of today use computers to design and engineer buildings that will endure the forces of nature, such as earthquakes, fires, and hurricanes. This modern skyscraper was also built to last. We've seen buildings completely destroyed like this before, but only when done intentionally. Danny Jawenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
This is controlled demolition.
That's a controlled demolition.
Segregated.
Sure? Yeah, absolutely.
Er is nagesprongen.
It's been imploded.
Het is in opdracht gebeurd.
It's a hired job.
Het heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Done by a team of experts.
Explosives are used to demolish buildings like this in just seconds. Okay, so it's a controlled demolition. What's the problem with that? Well, it happened on the afternoon of 9/11 at the World Trade Center. Let's just think about this. Controlled demolitions cannot be engineered and rigged in a day. It takes months. And therefore, this event must have been planned in advance.
Keep your eye on that building, it'll be coming down. Building
is about to blow up. Move it back. We are walking back. It's a building about to blow up.
Did they actually use the word brought down, and who was it that was telling you this?
In the fire department. And they did use the word, we're going to have to bring it down.
And these people heard explosions.
We heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. It looked like there was a shockwave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out. About a second later, the bottom floor caved out. The building followed after that.
He takes his hand off, and you hear 3, 2, 1, and it was boom, 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 boom.
And these reporters recognized it as a controlled demolition.
And I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion. It looked like it had been done by a demolition crew. The whole thing just collapsing down on itself.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
It was almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
So what's the problem if this was a planned demolition? Well, we are told by government agencies that this building came down as a result of normal office fires. The National Institute of Standards and Technology produced their final report in 2008.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
Well, what do you think brought down the building?
And what caught my eye is more than 1,300 architects and engineers examined the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects.
You are about to hear from architect of 23 years, Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Now there are more than 1,500 architects and engineers who say that it could not have been brought down by office fires. They are backed by 9/11 family members. We're calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm Richard Gage. Fires have never before caused the collapse of any skyscraper. Even though there are numerous examples of much hotter, larger, and longer-lasting fires in these buildings. And in the case of Building 7, the fire that NIST said started the collapse had actually burned out over an hour before. It could not have caused the collapse, as NIST claims. Yet this 47-story, modern steel-frame skyscraper, which was not hit by an airplane, collapses mostly into its own footprint, like a house of cards, as fast as a bowling ball falling off the side of the building, in just under 7 seconds. Listen to the experts.
Building number 7 descended in free fall for the first 100 feet, which means that there was absolutely no resistance to the descent whatsoever.
NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories. And going from motionless to free fall instantly, that's a bothersome part of the puzzle because NIST never explained it.
We've got a building that came down in its own footprint, so all of the columns really needed to be severed at the same time in order for that structure to fall the way that we saw.
The symmetry is the smoking gun.
The whole building completely comes down in one continuous motion. There couldn't have been any structural resistance.
According to NIST, the failure occurred at column 79 on level 12. They're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building.
It is possible that you could have a local failure as a result of a connection failing. But the likelihood of that failure dragging the entire building in such a fashion that all the columns would fail at the same time is an impossibility.
Impossibility?
Yes.
What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel. Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron. R.J. Lee Company, USGS, and Dr. Stephen Jones's work, all three separately found these microspheres.
In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red-gray chips which have different properties, and in the reaction they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction. And such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite.
There were these iron microspheres present in all of the dust samples that needed to have been formed in extremely high temperatures.
I've independently seen thermitic activity within 2 separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust. My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. All the characteristics of the microspheres tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
So thermite, if it was present at the World Trade Center and created this molten metal that so many witnesses and photographic evidence shows, would also explain the fact that the fires could not be put out at Ground Zero.
The only thing that is consistent with all of the evidence that we have that could cause such a thing is the use of thermite to cut through the steel.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Oh. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Yeah. Like lava.
Like lava
from a volcano.
Well, the manual gets into thermite, and if it says if you have melted steel or concrete, which we had on 9/11, we should test for it.
It's this fused element of steel, molten steel and concrete and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
We're asking for an investigation that follows national standards. There's no excuse to not test for this. If terrorists use explosives in 93, why didn't we test for them? If all these witnesses heard explosions, why aren't we testing for them?
NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look, because you don't expect to find evidence, and in fact the evidence is overwhelming. They state these conclusions for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence.
The Freedom of Information Act request to NIST was denied with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety?
The destruction of evidence was a criminal act in itself. It was already being carted away and destroyed when the FEMA investigators got there about a month after September 11th.
You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. When the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned. This is not science.
The scientific forensic evidence ignored by NIST but carefully reviewed by teams of technical professionals corroborates the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition. We traveled to 21 foreign countries and 32 American cities bringing this evidence to the attention of the public. And we're backed by 9/11 family members and other concerned citizens who are calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm a family member trying to find out the answers to the murder of 3,000 plus people. The bottom line is that it needs to be investigated properly.
Please look at architects and engineers. People all around the world, scientists all around the world, are questioning this. And there's some deep, deep explaining to do.
It took some kind of consciousness raising on my part before I was willing to look at the possibilities. And really, you need to go where the evidence leads.
As an engineer, I have 3 degrees in engineering. I signed that petition for architects and engineers for 9/11 truth some time ago because the American people absolutely need the truth of 9/11.
Look at the evidence. In fact, I'll say this very categorically. Any reasonable person who looks at the evidence that's been brought forward has got to come away with the feeling that something has to be done, a real investigation has to be put forward.
We will never heal. This country will never, ever, ever forget that day. We have to demand a new investigation. I want justice here.
The country owns this. We were all victims. You all should want answers. It's not just ours, not just mine. We all lost something that day.
It's distressing for everyone to come to terms with this evidence. But we must pursue the truth wherever it leads. Look at the evidence and decide for yourself.
Now, I will second that request to look at the evidence. If you've never done so, that video is very worth watching, comparing World Trade Center 7 particularly. In my experience, there's nothing more effective at helping people to see what's going on than showing them a video of the World Trade Center 7 collapse, asking them, have you ever seen this? If not, why do you think nobody bothered to show it to you? Did you know this building was never hit by a plane? Do you think those collapses are due to fire? And I've gotten into a lot of discussions with people about small details and foreknowledge and rigging the building with explosives because they had a power outage before and so on, but actually just looking at that building, it's very hard if you come at it with an open mind to say, yeah, that could possibly have happened due to fire. Although that video by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is a great website by the way, ae911truth.org, although that video is very worthwhile, I think they lost it a bit towards the end. I mean, as a platform to unite different people saying we demand an explanation, it's a nice thought, but do they actually think anybody's going to give them an investigation? Who are they demanding an investigation from? The universe at large? My granny? Or are they asking the same government whose Secretary of Defense announced the day before that they couldn't account for a quarter of the money that they'd been given, and who subsequently restructured the whole defense system as a result and hoiked up the military budget in the process? Is it even remotely credible that the US government is going to say, yes, let's have a real independent investigation? I mean, this is not in any way to underestimate their potential. I think the call for something to be done reflects deep-seated consumer mentality. I want justice seems to fit quite neatly next to I want a burger and fries. It's some product which will be provided by those who produce things, and we are mere infidels, we consume things. So I think it's a lot more likely that the independent investigation that a lot of people will certainly like to see will not be handed down from on high, but will be carried out by a large number of individuals all contributing their opinions, probably on some technology like a wiki. It won't be centralized, because if there was anything that revolutionary going on in a single place, that would soon become a target for the cyber police. But I certainly would encourage those people who are listening, if there is anyone listening who has privileged information, to think clearly. Do you think that the details of the 9/11 operation will be kept secret forever? Will they die with you? Or will we reach a stage at which people are convinced enough of what has gone on that they decide, okay, that guy's a blatant criminal, we're going to take appropriate steps, never mind what the officials state, we know what you did. And encourage anybody who was on the inside of that operation to think about how they're going to get that information out. Now, just to clarify, I think this is going to be justice served up a la the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, which handled the end of apartheid in South Africa, which said you will be protected to the extent that you demonstrate you are going to help us get to the bottom of what went on, with the overall aim of the process not being to make life miserable for the wicked perpetrators, but to help people understand what went on and to help prevent it from ever going on again. We're also going to get on later in the show to Luke Rutkowski as an example of taking the action that's needed rather than demanding someone else to do it. Now, having aired my concerns about the naivety of calling on them to give us an investigation, we'll now continue with an interview of Martin Summers, who is a member of a group called Reinvestigate 911. And they have a website at reinvestigate911.org. Now, he is being interviewed in 2011 by ex-BBC reporter Tony Gosling.
Now, one of the main things which is used to debunk people like you is saying, well, we've already had a 9/11 Commission inquiry, but we've also had this National Institute for Science and Technology report, the NIST report, which has concluded that really the official story is true, and all this talk that people like you go on about controlled demolition of buildings on September the 11th is nonsense.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they, as Mandy Rice Davis so famously put it. The government tells you what they want you to know, and that's what governments do. You can't take them at their word. These structures are not necessarily transparent. The main killer fact for me is Building 7, WTC-7, which some of our listeners may have heard of. A third building collapsed on the day of 9/11 at 5:20 in the afternoon, some hours after the first two buildings. It fell exactly into its own footprint, like the first two buildings did. It was reduced not just to rubble but to dust, but no plane crashed into it. So the whole major theory about plane jet fuels causing a fire which causes buildings to implode on their own footprints can't possibly be true about the third building, because the third building had no plane crashing into it, but it's still disintegrated in exactly the same way as the other two. But most people, I mean, it's only recently that WTC-7 has come to international attention. People like myself and our group have been aware of it all along, but the mainstream media basically ignored it for many years and then started to come out with silly stories about why this building had collapsed, which can't possibly be the same explanation as why the first two buildings collapsed. It just won't hold water. And I'm afraid the story basically is coming apart at the seams after 10 years. There's loads of research been done, and the government basically have not come up with a credible explanation of what happened.
Well, certainly the US military are sticking to their guns. And how would it have been possible to keep something, if it was a conspiracy, a cover-up of some kind? Many people would have had to have been involved in it. How on earth would they have managed to keep it secret all this time?
Well, first of all, you don't have to have that many people involved. What we know was happening with various exercises were going on the day of planes crashing into buildings. The whole US Air Force apparently was having a war game in northern Canada of a Soviet or Russian aeroplane attack over the North Pole, and that's why all of their aircraft were not actually functional around the east coast of the United States on the day. That's the story. I mean, that's the other major fact that I always point to. Where was the United States Air Force? We've had 10 years now, we've had an investigation. Everybody should be able to explain what happened to the United States Air Force. We had four airliners flying around in the most heavily defended airspace in the world. The Pentagon is probably the most heavily defended air point in world air defences. And four planes fly around for an hour and a half without being intercepted once. During the Battle of Britain in the 1940s, how long did it take for the RAF to get airborne once they'd picked up a radar trace? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? An hour and a half, the United States
Air Force. But these are airliners, Martin, and there was no warning of the attack.
It doesn't matter, does it? Radar shows you exactly where these things are. An airliner is bigger than a Messerschmitt. You should be able to find it. And, of course, they were telling us that they were seeing these blips on the screen. I mean, they were actually having a war game on the day, I understand, with lots of false blips. So it's because they were pretending to have a war game of planes crashing into buildings. And then, of course, actually some of those planes were real and ended up crashing into buildings. And this is speculation, of course, probably how it was done. Now, our position as we investigate 9/11 is we don't actually have theories about what happened. We're not in a position to understand what happened because we're not the police force. We haven't got the resources. All we do is point out the contradictions in the official narrative, and we demand a full investigation because it's not been properly looked into, and we don't try and speculate too much about what may have happened. I've got my own theories after all the research I've done over 10 years. I've got my own theories, but my theories are not what we're about. We're about pointing out why the official story can't be true and why another investigation may have to happen. And many members of the 9/11 commission resigned. Max Cleland, for example, the Democrat senator, resigned because he said this is a whitewash and I'm having no part of it. So I think we've already got warning signals flashing there, and people should take notice of them.
So, okay, ultimately, why? If it was a cover-up, if there was a conspiracy on September the 11th, then why was the point of it?
Well, I mean, as I say, I don't like to speculate on one level, because all we're pointing out is that the official story can't be true. I have got my own theories about why, and most of the listeners can probably work it out for themselves. It's not rocket science. Most American people, United States citizens, are actually quite nice people. They wouldn't want to go to war with foreign countries to steal their oil. And if somebody said to me, you're invading foreign countries to steal their oil, they'd be shocked. So, of course, they have to be scared out of their wits. They have to be herded along, and something terrible has to happen to them so that they feel as if they're under attack. And then, of course, they're willing to support the government in its various adventures abroad. And that's pretty clearly what's happened, to be honest. General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, people can look him up on the internet, Ivashov, Ivashov, he's basically saying quite straightforwardly, our position is this was an inside job, and he was the head of the Russian armed forces. He will have access to all Russian intelligence on the day and afterwards. And I suspect that these kind of people know what they're talking about.
And as Mandy Rice Davis might say, he would say that, wouldn't he?
He would.
Martin Summers is correct to point out the situation about the Air Force exercises. There's a lot of reports on this by Mike Rupert. If you go to our 911 category page, a lot of earlier unwelcome guests detail his uncovering how on that day, more than any other, there were a lot of exercises going on. Not proof in itself of anything, just one more circumstance to be borne in mind. Did the guys who organized the September the 11th event just get lucky on that score as well? Now then there's the matter of the air defence, which we shall hear a summary of by Kenneth Doust's New World Notes, which is mentioned on the Unwelcome Guests website, also has its own website, at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And this episode is from 2009.
Big problem number three for the show's listeners, lack of air defense. Something like, what, 2 hours elapsed between the time the first flying object hit the North Tower and the fourth flying object hit the dirt in Pennsylvania? Where the heck were the Air Force fighter jets? Plus the Pentagon? We are to believe that there are no missile batteries, no Air Force jets protecting the headquarters of the top brass of the entire U.S. military? Please. Here's a response from a man who works as a lawyer in Connecticut. I served in the Air Force, and we were made to understand that we were part of an elite immediate reaction team. Fighter pilots and flight line crews are on duty at all times, suited up and ready to take to the air. Within minutes, an Air Force pilot can reach any spot on the nation's perimeter and identify and destroy any intruder. An airliner used as a missile would be defenseless against a fighter, and it would be impossible for such an attack to succeed. When I saw the second airliner hit the building, I knew that it could not have happened without government approval, and I said so. I was at work at the time, and I got fired the next day. Jesus. That's why I'm proud to be an American. All right.
And thanks to Kenneth Douse, listener there, for that quick summary of U.S. air defenses. I think if we check the small print, we'll discover that earlier in 2001, shoot-down procedure was changed to require the personal authorization of the Secretary of Defense. That would be Donald Rumsfeld. I may be wrong on that, but I seem to recall that from earlier Unwelcome Guests episodes. Listen to Peter Dale Scott on that and how Rumsfeld deliberately made himself unavailable, thus avoiding the shoot-down. Thanks also to that listener for summarising dramatically the national mood. Now, I've made a strategic decision just to ignore President Bush, because I think he's basically a distraction. But on the issue of motive, PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, did issue a report, I think it was 1998, in which they talked about the need for a new Pearl Harbor, i.e. a catalyzing event, something that could persuade the American population it was time to go out and invade the Middle East. So they pretty much laid out a blueprint for what they intended to do. Did they think, oh, nobody will actually publicise this? Perhaps. Did they fail to appreciate the ability of the internet to spread information? I think that's also quite likely. And without that, mass communication tools are basically in the hands of the moneyed few, who may well have counted on the ability to prevent such information from spreading fast. Now we shall hear an interview with William Rodriguez, the janitor of the World Trade Center on that day, and he remarks that whilst he was the media's golden boy for a short period, when it emerged that he had unwelcome testimony, such as about the bombs going off in the building, then he was no longer persona grata. And this interview is by Tony Gosling, again, from 2005.
Now, one of the most important eyewitnesses to the attacks was World Trade Center janitor William Rodriguez. When the plane hit his tower, rather than running away, he ran up the stairs to open fire doors, which he knew were closed, to allow people to escape to safety. I spoke to William back in 2005 when he visited Bristol to give a presentation at the old IMAX cinema at Bristol.
I am William Rodriguez. I am the last survivor pulled from the rubble from the North Tower, last person to come out of the North Tower, and I worked in the building for almost 20 years. I was the person in charge of all the stairwells of the North Tower. I have the only master key that was used on 9/11, and became after that the leader of all the victim survivors of New York, and organize and advocate for changes from then on for victims of terrorism.
So tell me, why was the master key so important?
The master key was very important because there were only 5 master keys available in the whole complex. And on that day, the people with the other 4 master keys were trained for egress and escape techniques and first aid techniques were the first ones to run out. So I found myself in the difficult situation of deciding what to do. And using the master key was crucial at that moment to save hundreds of lives. Otherwise, they will be probably stuck at that moment in different offices without knowing how to get out. So that was the importance of that key.
Can you just take us briefly through your day as it started normally? What time?
My day started usually at 8 o'clock. I come in. We have a punching clock for the time card. The office was located at the basement of building one, the North Tower. The building has 6 sub-levels, and those sub-levels were located between B1 and B6 for the support of the whole complex, like the Department of Painting, the Department of Structural Design, everything that had to do with engineering and support and maintenance of the complex was located on those floors.
But it was very different on this day, wasn't it? You arrived at 8 o'clock as normal, but what happened?
I came in late. I called that I was going to be a little late and got there at 8:30. I started talking to the supervisor. We were actually exchanging information about... I just came back from a vacation from Puerto Rico, and he wanted to know everything about Puerto Rico. So we were chit-chatting, and 8:46, we heard an explosion, and it was coming from the lower levels. And as I thought at that moment, it was that it was an electrical generator that blew up at that moment. I was going to say, listen, I think it's an electrical generator. And at that very moment, the impact on the top, we hear an impact at the top of the building.
How can you be so certain of the time?
Very simple. We were right next to the time clock. We were right there. The time clock, remember, I just have to punch in, and we were right there.
But what you've said is very strange for most people, that there was an explosion from the bottom of the World Trade Center before the impact of the aircraft.
Yeah, and I will have enough experience to know if it was coming from the top or coming from the bottom. Again, for being in the building for so many years, the experience alone will give you at least a sense of where the noises are coming from in the building.
So what happened then after the plane hit the top? Did the building shake?
The building shake, and all the false ceiling completely collapsed. The walls cracked. The sprinkler system got activated. We had an explosion after that, and a person coming into the office running saying, "Explosion! Explosion! Explosion!" with his hands extended. And when I look at his hands, I saw something hanging from the top of the fingertips, and I did not know what it was. And when I looked at it, I realized it was his skin was pulled from under his armpits all the way to the top of the fingertips. Imagine you take off a glove and you let it hanging. That's exactly how he looked at the moment. And then when I look at his face, I saw missing parts of his face by the ear side and on the right side. And I said, "What happened? What happened?" And he said, the elevators, the lifts. And at that moment, I just couldn't understand why was he saying the elevators. Apparently, he was in front of the elevators. And on the elevator shaft, there was fire. And the vapor pulled his skin out of his arms, just like that. And the guy was in shock. And I said, everybody out. And the building was oscillating so hard that you could feel the floor moving under you. I pushed everybody out from the office. There were 14 people. And the guy that was burned, he was a black guy named Felipe David. I put his arm around my shoulder, and I took it out of the building. I led everybody out through the loading dock that faced the Vestry area, which is towards the north side. And when I got out, there was an ambulance coming, running like crazy. And I stopped the ambulance, put the guy inside the ambulance, and... that's when I heard that a plane hit the building on a security guard's radio. When I turned around, that's when I saw the hole, I saw the debris coming down, I saw the fire, but I couldn't see the antenna of the building.
Okay, Most people don't know about explosions, but it sounds to me, particularly having one explosion before the plane hit and also this possible explosion of your friend, about explosives in the building.
Mr. Felipe David, the guy that was burned, was reunited with me like 3.5 months after, because he saw me on TV talking about problems with the families and the survivors. And he called the doctors and said, that's the guy that saved me. And the doctor called the news media, and the news media made the reunion with him, actually, for the cameras. And it was very emotional and it was a catharsis.
So what about these explosions? Most people haven't heard of explosions. What do you put it down to? And, what did you see on the day?
Well, there were explosions, and actually when I was pulled from the rubble the same day, I spoke about it on CNN and on national news, and I wasn't the only person that talked about that. Other news reporters that were in the area were talking about it, and all of a sudden the whole new item of what was happening on that day fizzled out or was actually changed as events were unfolding. But I don't understand why people all of a sudden tried to forget those initial interviews, which were crucial. And actually, we testified for the 9/11 Commission, and that testimony didn't show up on the final report. So we are very amazed and at the same time discouraged that most of the information that were available on that day were not taken in consideration.
So you have one of the main master keys, and you went up to open up doors. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, when I came back running inside the building because I saw the hole and I saw the fire, I started screaming to everybody that we have to go back because of the people on Windows of the World. That was the restaurant that was located on top of the building. And nobody wanted to go back in. And I said, we got to go back in. And so I took it upon myself of going back by myself through the basement. And there I found two guys, a guy from the janitorial department named Jimmy Barrett, and a lady called Maureen, which is, she was in charge of the security for the Marriott Hotel, which was half destroyed too after that. And they didn't know what was happening. So I told them that they have to get out because we had an emergency in the building. They didn't even know that the building was hit by a plane because they were located on the other building. For that, I ran back to building one, on the basement, all of this on the basement, found a recycling guy that told me there were two people stalking in an elevator. And I put my ear in one of the elevators, and effectively there were two people screaming that they were going to drown. I couldn't understand why will they drown? And apparently was that all the water from the sprinkler system from the whole complex was going down the elevator shaft, and they got encapsulated between B2 and B3. Now, it's really deep if you think about it. And so I said, God, please give me a hand. What can I do? And I found a pipe in the area, and I took that metal and opened the doors, but it was empty. There was, an empty hollow area there because there was no elevator. So all the water on my side, once the door opened, went rushing in with more force, so the screaming was louder. And at that moment, I said the same thing. God help me. I need to find something, how to help these people. And at that very moment, I remember that the electricians, they have ladders that they use to change light bulbs and things like that. And they always located them in front of the garbage compactors, but they tied them up with chains because people usually stall them because they will go on the loading dock, put them in the truck, and take them out. So they were always tied up with chains. And I was just hoping to find only one on chain. And the miracle was that the only one that was on chain was the longest of all of them. It was an 18 feet long ladder. And I took it, dropped it in, went inside, opened the latch, got both people out. One of them is Salvatore Gianbanco, a painter. The other one was a delivery guy. Brought them outside, put them in an ambulance, and went back running inside the building. They did survive, too. And they did the reunion again for television months after. And I tell you this because it's incredible that when I came out and say the story once I was pulled from the rubble, a lot of people said, oh, this guy is Superman. They didn't even believe it. And all of a sudden, people started coming out and validating the story. And those same people that actually were criticizing, all of a sudden, they did the push to make me a national figure in the United States.
Can you explain, though, about your master key? Why was this so important?
The master key was very important for the simple reason that the building was a Class A building. A Class A building meaning that it was a skyscraper over 50 floors up. They have to encapsulate fires on the floors in a matter of an emergency. That meant that three doors will not open on the stairwells and one will open for escape. Three won't open, one will open, all the way up to 110th floor. So that key was crucial because with that key, those floors that didn't open will open with that key.
Right, so there would be many people who were trying to get into the stairwells Correct. And down who couldn't.
Correct. If you went from a re-entry door down to another floor, you wouldn't be able to. But if you were in those offices and you tried to get out, yes, you could. But the problem was that the World Trade Center has 70,000 people working there, and the turnaround was so huge that a lot of people did not know where the exits were, and they only have drills twice a year. And later on our advocacy, we made them change the law, and at the same time, we are asking requirements that any buildings over a certain amount of floor will have mandatory training for new employees.
Martin, just briefly, the 9/11 Commission report, William gave a full report to them, but they didn't use any of his testimony whatever in the final published version of the report. I mean, what do you put that down to?
It's a cover-up. It's a whitewash. It's quite simple, really. You said briefly, whitewash.
Well, the obvious thing, though, is that the 9/11 Commission thought that he wasn't a credible witness.
Well, but I think the listeners can make their own judgment about that. Frankly, they originally bigged William up as a great hero, which he was on the day. He saved hundreds of lives.
That's right. There were film going around the world of him with George W.
There's
Bush.
There's a picture of him shaking hands with George Bush because he was one of the heroes of the day. But when he started saying what he saw and knew what had happened on the day, he was immediately turned into persona non grata. And, of course, we've had him over here in Britain, and we took him round, and he did a gig for us in the IMAX cinema in Bristol. And I think people need to hear his testimony.
Now, Scott Forbes was an English chap who worked in New York's World Trade Center at the time of the 9/11 attacks and lost 89 of his work colleagues in those attacks. From his nearby flat on his day off on Manhattan, Scott witnessed the second plane strike the tower just below the offices where his colleagues were working, whilst being on the phone to them. Here is his eyewitness account of the security system's power down and mysterious cabling contractors working in the building all through the weekend immediately preceding the attacks.
My name's Scott Forbes. I worked and still work for a financial institution who were housed in the World Trade Center, Tower 2, South Tower. We were on floors 90 and 94 to 97 on the South Tower, and consequently the company I work for lost a lot of people on that day. We lost 89 employees plus a number of other contract staff who worked on our floors.
You weren't there on the day. How did you manage to escape what happened on September the 11th?
I had the day off work, a day off in lieu, as I'd worked the previous weekend. That was Saturday the 8th, Sunday the 9th. Occasionally, working in technology, occasionally I was asked to work weekends, and so we would have a day off in lieu for that effort. And so my day off was on Tuesday the 11th, which is why I was not there. The reason I was working on the 8th and 9th was because of a power down condition in the South Tower. We were given approximately 3 weeks notice by the Port Authority that there would be no power in the top half of the tower, and as our data center was on the 97th floor, and this was for a global institution, it meant we had to switch off all our systems. In the time I'd been in the company, we'd not gone through that operation before, and we certainly didn't plan for that operation. So to go through the process of shutting down all of our systems one by one was an enormous exercise, taking many hours. It wasn't a question of just turning off a switch. We had to shut down applications, we had to shut down networks, physically shut down servers, shut down databases, which is the work I do. So the operation involved was pretty massive and the planning involved was very rigorous. And it wasn't just myself working that weekend, there were many others, probably about 30 people working that weekend on the shutdown exercise. And after the work, so-called work, was completed, the restart of all the systems. And in fact, we didn't finish on the weekend. On the Monday evening, the 10th, we still had some systems not fully operational.
So what days were the actual power down happening and what reason was given?
The reason that was given was that there was a recabling exercise. It was as general as that. The days of the power down were Saturday the 8th and Sunday the 9th of September. The shutdown started around noon on Saturday the 8th, and we were bringing up the systems from around 2, 3 p.m. on Sunday the 9th. So the period was about 24 hours.
So how did that whole operation go from your company's point of view? Was it all successful? Did you manage to bring everything down and then the power went down and then you brought everything up fine afterwards?
Apart from these one or two systems that we were having issues with, everything else went fairly smoothly. On the Monday evening, I was in the office till around 7 that night with several other people trying to sort out the systems that we're having issues with on the Monday night. But apart from those, the shutdown and the startup went like clockwork, fairly standard, you know, didn't make us think too much. It was just unusual to have the power down and to have no power. And just to point out one thing, we had a generator in the data center, part of our legal compliance, being a financial institution in the state of New York, was that we had to have a backup power supply, but it was considered whether we could live on that without having to shut down, and it was decided no, we shouldn't, that for safety we should shut everything down.
Isn't that sort of thing quite normal? You would have to be prepared for a power cut, surely?
If there was a power cut, the generator would kick in normal circumstances, and I don't know the full details, but I think the generator was equipped to last probably about 12 hours, which would deal with most power cut conditions. So if there was a shock power cut, sure, the generator would kick in, no systems would go down. As the power was being removed from the building and there was a recabling exercise going on, we considered it a little bit more dangerous and unusual, and therefore we decided to shut everything down just in case the period did extend longer than a 12-hour period.
Now, if there are recabling exercises going on, you would expect, I would imagine, you would expect there to be quite a lot of activity in the building, or the people doing the recabling.
When I was there, I did see people from outside agencies. We didn't pay special attention to these guys. We just thought they were engineers or builders or maintenance staff. There were people around, but we didn't pay any particular attention to them. All I can say is that there was unusual activity. There were men in uniforms, like overalls, carrying toolboxes, and there was lots of cabling around and so on. But, you know, at the time we didn't pay special attention to them, frankly.
So there was obviously something actually going on where there was workmen that wouldn't normally be there. Maybe you could just take us through, describe people that you saw.
Sure. Going into the towers from the ground floor, employees had security badges in order to pass through gates to reach the elevators. Once you were in the elevator, it was just push button. To gain access into our offices, we then had a separate security badge to gain access into our offices. So all of that was in operation going in on the Saturday to do the power down. From the ground floor, it was clear that there was activity, there were people around beyond the normal. The ground floor elevator took us to the lobby at 78, and on the 78th floor lobby, again, there was unusual activity. There were people around and cabling and boxes, toolboxes. Then from there, I took the elevator up to the 97th floor, and I didn't see any activity on our floor, frankly. I remember it on the lobby areas.
Okay, so can you just describe these people? What did they look like? I mean, did they have any sort of like big company logo or anything like that on their jackets as they're working?
I can't remember specific details about individuals. You know, I can't describe you individual guys.